Hello, everyone. This is Mike Quincy, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Lamont Wood, and we will discuss his theories and fascinating research in his new book, Out of Place in Time and Space, which is about inventions, beliefs, and artistic anomalies that he believes were impossibly ahead of their time. And he has discovered countless inventions, art, and other items that were not yet created or even imagined when they appeared in ancient paintings, books, and other places. Sounds all very interesting. Welcome to the program, Lamont.
I'm glad to be here.
Fine. Looking back, I must say, from time to time, in a number of books or articles to illustrate the type of thing that you're covering, I think there are some ancient drawings, pictures, or whatever that continually get used. So I'm sure my listeners will identify with some of them as we go along. What started you out in life to have such an interest in these, I would call them curiosities, really?
Yeah. I was always a history buff and did fairly random reading as part of that hobby. I kept running across things that struck me as being kind of out of place in any linear conception of history. A good example of that, I suppose, would be the item in the book about Admiral Nelson's plans for the Battle of Trafalgar. And he wrote a memo to his captain about how he wanted the battle to go, and it's laid out numerically. He wanted like a part of his fleet to attack X part of the French fleet with X number of ships against their X number of ships and stuff like that. And you wonder why he was dwelling on numbers like that, but this wasn't explained at the time to anybody. The battle took place in 1805. In 1916, someone invented what they call the N-squared law of mutual attrition, also known as the Lanchester equations. And they discovered that his memo exactly fit that, that it was written as if he used the N-squared law of mutual attrition to plan what he was going to do. But like that was 111 years later. How that could be, I don't know. Presumably he came up with something similar on his own. He didn't tell anybody that died with him. He died in that battle. So I started looking for similar things and kept finding them, basically. I came up with the high concept of what I call reverse anachronisms, which, again, are things out of time. Now, a conventional anachronism, of course, is when you go to the movies. And the movie's about Rome, let's say. But the actors are speaking English. But you accept that because you don't know Latin. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing particularly ominous about it. They've simply made the decision to actually connect with the audience and make it in English, of course. But it's an anachronism. They ought to be speaking Latin. Now, a reverse anachronism, but anyway, it's a portrayal of things out of place that's projected into the past. So I came up with the idea of reverse anachronism, where you look into the past and find something from the present there. Mm. And this would be the case with, like, say, Admiral Nelson and his plan, which appears to have something from 111 years in his future. If we have reverse anachronisms in the past, logic demands that there be reverse anachronisms in the future. And those, of course, are hard to identify because, by definition, we wouldn't recognize them or understand what they are. Mm. But we seem to be surrounded by them because these reverse anachronisms start out that way. When Admiral Nelson wrote his plan, that was reverse anachronism from the future. Now we've come into sync with it, so to speak, synchronization. And now it's a reverse anachronism from the past. My favorite one would be the one I start out with, Chapter 1, Reverse Anachronisms in the Past, which would be, of course, the picture that's been hanging on the wall of a French museum for who knows how many centuries. It's painted in 1460, and it's a fairly conventional Madonna and Child photo of the Christ Child sitting in the lap of the Madonna, except when you look carefully at what the Christ Child is doing, and he appears to be depicted as playing with a pull-string flying toy helicopter. which is kind of weird because, like I said, this is 1460, and the helicopter wasn't invented until flying ones, anyway, really ones, but about 1906. Of course, Leonardo da Vinci, of course, is known for have sketched out something like that. But he was 8 years old when this painting was made. I mean, he didn't do it. So, and another excellent, I could go through, just go on and on, but I think maybe the real lesson here is that time isn't as linear as we think, or that our ancestors were smarter than we often give them credit for. That they often knew what they were doing. Things didn't always catch on, though. They were operated without scientific publishing industry to circulate new ideas worldwide within hours nowadays. So we don't see the kind of progress that we take granted nowadays.
Right. I think from my point of view, having regard to the subject we're talking about, because we have been in the space age for quite a long time, when you go back and look at descriptions of weird happenings in the skies, such as in the Bible, or you see ancient inscriptions or drawings, I think we're more able to identify them as something that was futuristic. Have you found that to be the case where your investigations are concerned?
Well, I'm a little leery of such identifications, because what we're in danger of doing is taking our sort of graphic vocabulary and imposing it on people who had their own graphic vocabulary. Mm. And they're deciding that they're saying what we would have said if, I don't know, they would, you know, you follow me. The fact that, for instance, we see what appear to be disc-like shapes in the skies in some paintings from the Renaissance, for instance, doesn't mean the artist was seeing flying saucers. Mm-hmm. And we see cave paintings of what they maybe were halos or something, and some people think those are helmets, or maybe they were halos. I mean, the halo means something to us. It doesn't mean the person is wearing a helmet, and maybe that meant something to the cave painter, too. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very dangerous. On the other hand, you keep running across things, don't we, when you do look for them. But just, especially, though, in the churchyard in the Renaissance, really, these things, I remember they had a very extensive graphic vocabulary. And these paintings were expensive pieces of expensive projects commissioned by people who knew what they wanted, and the artist had better supply it or he wasn't going to get paid. So nothing got in there by accident. And the artist didn't stick something in the painting because he happened to see it in the sky. And we can't sit there and say, oh, he must have been stuck stuff in there because UFOs or flying saucers were up there all the time back then. It doesn't mean that. But it still gets your attention, and you still have to wonder what's going on sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
It is fascinating.
When I made my comment about descriptions, say, for example, in the Bible, I was thinking in terms of our modern term of flying saucers, which was given for an object that the person couldn't find any other name for, but very adequately described the shape of what he saw. And then you can look back and find in times before flying craft of any description, and objects moving around were described as flying shields. And then you can sort of relate the two, I think, because that was the best way to describe it at the time.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And there are such things. I don't talk about the flying shield in my book, but there are such accounts. But again, the past is a foreign country, and we just can't assume that we're talking about the same thing we're talking about. Mm. But again, it is evocative, isn't it? And I think further, worth looking into.
Absolutely, yes. Well, I mean, artifacts presumably give you something more concrete to base your thoughts on. I believe in your book, correct me if I'm wrong about this. You have the artifact that was found in Egypt, the sort of golden object that clearly looks like some sort of flying craft.
Oh, yeah, that's it. The Fakira bird. Actually, it's made out of wood, and it does look like a child's toy airplane, a modern child's toy airplane.
Yeah.
But it's not a very convincing airplane. There's no horizontal stabilizer in the rear. There's a vertical rudder, and, and it would need that if it were going to, if it were based on an actual flying machine. If it was some kind of model representation of that, there would be that. And on the front, there is a painted bird face, but not a very convincing bird face, for that matter. So as a point I make in the book, it's not a very convincing airplane. It's not a very convincing bird. Maybe it was a weather vane, you know. As a flying, you know, as a flying toy, no, it wouldn't have worked. It's too heavy. Everything's balanced wrong.
Well, I'm sure you're right there to consider other interpretations. But strangely enough, with that particular artifact, it wasn't too long ago that I read that someone had followed the shape and the design of it, and they said it would actually fly. So it's strange,
isn't it? If you made out of a styrofoam or something, put on a horizontal stabilizer, it would not fall to your feet. It would go away. But I think if it was more of a toy, basically, than anything else. Maybe a toy weather vane, for that matter. Like I say, it's not a convincing bird, and it's not a convincing airplane.
Now,
a lot of toys aren't really convincing when you look at them, are they?
No, absolutely. Now, on the cover of your book, you have got the Madonna, and in the background, you have magnified the object that is there, and I would guess for anybody like myself, who has followed the history of UFOs since about the late 1940s, I would look at that and say, that is a spacecraft. What did you think about that one?
Well, when I looked at it, I first thought, well, it must be a mountain view looking downward, and that's some kind of boat. Or then I looked at it and said, no. But then, of course, you go to the nativity story in the Bible, and they imply that the Holy Family is in some kind of cattle thing, and which is open to the outside, and you can see this landscape, and behind her this hill and these people on it, you can barely see it, and with sheep around them, and that fits into the biblical story of the nativity, of the shepherds watching their flocks by night, being overawed by the heavenly host telling them to go witness this thing that's happening. So I think that's what's happening here. You have shepherds on the hill, and they're being overawed by the thing in the sky. Now, you as an artist, how would you depict the heavenly host? He has what appears to me to be a rowboat as seen by fish, you know, from the underside. and maybe the oars coming out are supposed to be golden rays or something.
Yeah.
Now, I think in many of these cases, what the artist is doing is based on the conception of the cosmos they had at the time, which is that the Earth and the solar system are enclosed in a celestial or crystal sphere, and any visitation from heaven or whatever would have to go through a hole in that crystal sphere, and that's maybe what we're seeing here, sort of a rent in the firmament up there. I really think that's what it is. I don't think he's trying to depict a UFO. I really think if the church wanted UFOs depicted in their paintings, they would have done so, and there wouldn't be any ambiguity. Because remember, these again are expensive commission projects, and everything in there is there for a reason, and because the artist was told to put it there.
Well, it has.
But again, you know, if you want to believe elsewhere, I can't really say otherwise. Throughout, I try to stick to the rationalist viewpoint, the Occam's razor thing, which is that the explanation that is requires the fewest assumptions is the one to go with.
Yeah.
But I'd be the first to admit that simplest explanation is not always the correct one, and certain fields is almost never correct, like organic chemistry, for instance. They have very complex.
It does make you wonder whether some artists had actually seen some sort of phenomena, and very cleverly and perhaps even cheekily introduced it into something like a normal painting. Perhaps they thought, I'll be a bit clever and I'll pop that one in there to see if anybody noticed it even.
I agree, it's a natural suspicion. But again, these are expensive projects. I don't think anything got in there by accident.
Right.
So
I think the explanations that you see get a little bit more difficult when I can come to one very popular painting that's often shown in other books, and that is the one where you appear to have a large number of odd objects plus ones that look like telegraph poles, which if you interpret them in the modern understanding, if you like, of things we see, might have been motherships or some other objects. What was your opinion about that one?
Well, which one are we talking about now?
The one that shows people looking up into the sky, which is almost full of objects that look like telegraph poles, and then other ones.
The one from 1428, is that what we're talking about?
I wouldn't know the date, but one that's quite well known, and I know it's featured in your book.
Oh, okay. I assume you're talking about the one from 1710, the one from the Baptism of Christ, the Dutch painting by, what's his name, Erich van de Gelder. And he is, it shows a group of people, and it's night, and there's this, the sky is overcast, but up in the clouds there's sort of a circular lit spot, and there are rays coming down from it. And there's a bright spot in the center of the circular lit spot, in fact, and it's easy to convince yourself this must be a flying saucer, especially with the resolution images that you see online or in magazines, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if you go get the high-res version of this painting, which I had to pay for from a museum, I believe, in England, you see that the central bright spot in this apparent flying saucer is a dove. And this goes into the biblical account of the baptism of Christ by John the Baptist. A dove came down upon him. The Holy Spirit came down upon him as if for a dove. Okay. And and presumably the rays of light are part of that manifestation. And coming through the clouds, he assumed that it would light up a circular space around the dove. The end result, again, it looks like a flying saucer flying over the crowd. But like I say, if you get the high-res version, you see that it's a lit area of cloud, not a physical object, and that there's a dove in the center. But again, when you look at it initially, it's quite convincing that it's a flying saucer.
Right, yes,
and if that's what you want to believe, you know, I can't sit here and, you know, be snide and say, absolutely, it isn't. I'm not really in a position to, you know, pop anybody's bubbles here. Although sometimes some people I talk to about these things, I do feel like I'm at a children's party sometimes popping balloons. But again, all I can do is stick to the rationalist viewpoint and try for the simplest explanation. And admittedly, that doesn't always work. And there are things in the book I can't really explain anyway. These paintings, you know, I can dance around and say, you know, and say, well, probably not. There are other things I can sit here and scratch my head about. I assume you're going to ask which one that is. and the one I can least explain is probably the one that's, I don't know, maybe best known and totally unknown to a lot of people. Jules Verne was well known as a science fiction author from the 19th century.
Yeah.
And actually, most of his novels were action-adventure. They were not science fiction. His first novel was, though, written in 1865, and it depicts an American effort to send three men to the moon in an aluminum capsule launched from Florida. They circle the moon, they return to Earth, they land in the Pacific Ocean, and are picked up by the U.S. Navy. Now, does any of that sound familiar?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Now, where did he get that? Of course, he doesn't have it nailed. I mean, he has them shot out of a cannon instead of launched from a rocket. That wouldn't work. That would kill the astronauts. But it would be more believable, I assume, to read as 1965. But he has a lot of other stuff nailed. He has, you know, free fall and stuff like that. And oddly enough, there's something in about when they're starting construction about the Texas politicians making trouble because they wanted involvement in the project. Now, that did happen in the Apollo program, and that is why Mission Control is located in Houston, to buy them off, basically. So, again, where do you get that? I mean, as if he took the actual moon program and simplified it and for readers in 1865. It's really dumbfounding. And again, I have no explanation. Occam's razor doesn't work on stuff like this. I have no way to even approach it for you. So, if you want to come up with some, you want to invoke time travelers, UFOs, go ahead. I can't say otherwise.
Right. Well, I think you have to agree that if you look at the present day science fiction writers, or if you look back a bit, you can see that they have intuitively, possibly, predicted things to come, which perhaps 20, 30, 40 years later, you can actually acknowledge as being realistic. So
right.
could one apply that to, say, 50 years ago or 100 years ago? Were people then sort of picking it up somehow?
Well, you know, engineers often think along the same lines because they're problem-solving, and the problem is the same for all of them. And I think that explains a lot of Jules Verne's approach. He knew you had to get launched into free fall, headed toward the moon, circle around, all that stuff. But like I said, that doesn't explain the Texas politicians, little things like that. Or landing in the Pacific Ocean and being picked up by the U.S. Navy. That, you know, you'd think he'd write in that they managed to land on land or something. So it's just, it's mind-boggling at some level.
Yes.
But, no, there are other things in the book. They're fairly obviously engineers thinking along the same lines, this, in parallel, just maybe centuries apart. A good example of that would be the Countess of Lovelace, Ada Augusta Byron King, who wrote a computer program that was published in 1843, which is almost exactly before 100 years before the first computer was built. Mm-hmm. Now, she was anticipating that a computer would be built. Her friend Babbage was working on one, a mechanical one. It had been probably the size of a tennis court. They'd probably need a steam engine to crank it. But they would have actually fed it data on punch cards and things like that. And it had a built-in printer to spew out the answers. But he never quite got it built. I think he, mostly from what you call creeping futurism. He kept dropping everything and redoing the plans, and he was partially funded by the British government, who eventually lost faith in him and stopped sending, and cut off the funding, and that ended it. But with more professional management, they might actually pull it off, and the results would have been fascinating. Especially to us, looking backwards, it's almost mind-boggling that they could have even conceived this, much less, come within a few years of pulling it off. It's as if maybe humanity has this, innate hunger for computational power. When PCs did come out in the 80s, there was a mind-boggling acceleration of demand for them, and now everyone has one. We can hardly get by without them. Now everyone's on Facebook and all this other stuff. We have a digital environment that was previously unknown. It really, rivals, the revolution that Gutenberg came up with, the personal book. Now we have the personal computer. And if they could have done this in the 1840s, admittedly, it would have been the same. It would have been, big mechanical computers rather than personal computers. But who knows what they could have done with it. It's quite intriguing to think about it. And science fiction novels have been written about that, what you call alternate fiction, assuming that they did pull it off and did do something along those lines. What would the impact of that have been? It probably major, but ever done information technology development project before. This was the first one ever done, so you can't really blame them for botching it.
No. I mean, from a personal point of view, when you look back, do you accept the idea that different types of extraterrestrials have been visiting the Earth for hundreds, if not thousands, of years?
Well, I think it's undecided. I think it's quite likely there are extraterrestrials out there who have their, you know, are sentient and all that. Whether they would be interested in visiting us, I don't know. The whole idea that there's these powerful beings up there watching over it reminds me too much of, like, classical Greek religion with the Olympian gods up there, and they keep maintaining some involvement in human affairs. If I were a Greek god, I don't think I'd be interested in human affairs. If I was a extraterrestrial capable of star travel, why would I be interested in human affairs? Especially I would have to come to Earth to meet one. I don't see what their agenda would be. Again, I think we're taking our viewpoint and imposing it on someone else that we've never met. We can't even imagine what their viewpoint and their agendas are. Mm. But I'm pretty sure that they're not like ours. Second, if they did exist, I doubt if we could stand in the same room and have a conversation with them, because they're probably optimized for different pressures and environments and temperatures and chemical mixtures of the atmosphere, et cetera, et cetera. Even gravity, acceleration, all that would be different for them.
The only thing that crosses my mind when on this particular subject is that one has to believe that some of these extraterrestrials come from civilizations that could be thousands of years ahead of us, and the sort of problems that you visualize, as you've mentioned, they may have totally overcome. And the reason I asked you about your beliefs in that respect was a number of ancient drawings that exist, which I'm sure you must have seen in your quest for looking up information, which seem to depict beings that are clearly not human and may well in some cases be wearing some type of, say, astronaut's gear. So I was trying to relate to that to see what you thought about those.
Well, again, I think it's very dangerous. Again, it's very easy to take our visual vocabulary, our graphical vocabulary, and impose it on people who had their own vocabulary. Maybe they had people in these pictures who were wearing helmets or gloves or something. But soldiers wear helmets. People in cold weather wear gloves. I remember there's a one from a Mayan tomb people keep pointing to because they think it shows some ancient astronaut because he appears to be wearing a fancy helmet. He's also barefoot, So you can't go very far off that. So I really think that if these extraterrestrials are so far ahead of us would be interested in visiting us for some whatever reason. I think if they had all these things at their power to let them get here, for one thing, I think they'd have no trouble disguising their arrival or presence. And if they didn't want us to know we were here, we wouldn't know they were here. And if they did want us to know they were here, we would know all about it, and it would be unambiguous. But really, that's what I think. And again, I feel like I'm popping balloons at a children's party or something, but that is where, Occam's razor takes me. That to me is the simplest answer. Now, it's not a very satisfying answer sometimes. People, I think, crave to have these new-style Olympian gods up there watching over them and being involved in human affairs, but I see no reason for that.
I think you said the word there that sometimes might explain the visitation of extraterrestrials, because obviously that word didn't exist hundreds or thousands of years ago. And if you read into the word gods visited races from the skies, then you could well assume they are talking about extraterrestrial visits. So there's some indication that some visits certainly might well have taken place.
Yeah, you can't say no, can you? And I think
deserves
for us. I think we need to look at it with open eyes. But doing so we have to admit the possibility that this is all human invention, that there were no extraterrestrials.
Yeah.
Or that if there are extraterrestrial visits, they're manifested in ways that we hadn't thought about. They're not this, but just some other manifestations we haven't looked at or thought about. Like I say, I think if they wanted to disguise themselves, they could very easily do that, and we wouldn't know how to look for it immediately. We might eventually figure it out. But,
right. Now, we've been speaking about the group of objects, etc., that you refer to, I think, as the first kind, that is, things from our present that show up in the past.
Right.
Tell us a bit about your views of things from our future that show up in our past.
Well, first let me point out that most of these things that from our present that show up in the past were, when they first discovered, were from the future. I mean, this was, time moves on. Now, a good example of that would be the so-called Antikythera mechanism that was found a seabed off a Greek island in 1901.
Oh, yes.
And at first it was just a jumble of corroded bronze gears. You can figure out what it was, basically. Because at the time it was a reverse anachronism from their future. Nowadays, more than 100 years later, we have analyzed it and realized what it is, largely because it's come in the synchronization of our present. It's an ancient Roman computer. Here in the world of computers and of our digital environment, we relate to it. But we understand what it is.
Yes.
It's not a programmable digital machine like a modern computer. It's what we used to call an analog computer, where the programming is built into the design, especially of the layout of the gears. It was mostly a device to reconcile the lunar calendar with the solar calendar. It did some other things too. It's quite complicated, in fact. And it has sort of kind of gearings in it that we thought weren't invented until the Industrial Revolution. I think the epicyclic gearing, what they call planetary gearing. That if you have a car with an automatic transmission, it's built into the gears there and the axle. And the fact that it shows up on a Roman device is pretty startling, but there's no reason it could not have invented it. Reconciling the lunar calendar and solar calendar is something we still do. We figure the date for Easter based on the lunar calendar, and you say, well, when it is it? You know, so we say, it's on April so-and-so, and that's the solar calendar. Like I say, that's an example of a reverse anachronism from the future, but now it's one from the present. Now, by definition, we would have a hard time figuring out recognizing a reverse anachronism from the future because we don't know what it is. It's just, we either ignore it or take it as noise or misidentify it. But I have one candidate in the book, and that would be the so-called Voynich manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can't figure out what it is, basically. Though it's apparently something. It's a manuscript book of about 240 pages that's been dated to about 1420, which is before the printing press was invented, so automatically it's hand-painted and hand-lettered. And it's written out by someone who knew the language. It's written with facility. It's like you can tell from the handwriting, the guy who wrote it,
yeah,
knew, he knew the language. And they can take the language and subject it to various mathematical analysis and show that it is not word salad, and it follows set rules that they can identify. And has a consistent alphabet throughout. But the problem is, it's an alphabet not seen anyplace else. Those rules aren't the rules of any known language. They have yet to be able to decipher it. And then the illustrations constantly appear to be about something, but aren't really when you look at them. There's like illustrations of botanical information that don't match any known plants, of what apparently are astronomical information that don't match anything from astronomy, plus a bunch of weird things of plumbing and naked women and something from some kind of manic Dr. Seuss stuff. It's very, very weird. Now, some people think it's a hoax. I would say that it's very difficult to come up with something that keeps almost seeming to have information, but never actually does have any discoverable information. You'd think something would slip through eventually. The other theory is that it represents the activity of someone with obsessive compulsive disorder. And there are people who with that have been known to invent their own alphabets, their own languages, their own worlds, for that matter. But again, those worlds, those languages, are usually based on something in the sufferer's experience, and you expect to be able for that to show through. And usually, in such cases, you can see it with a little analysis. Here, that hasn't happened. Also, it would have to, since it's 1420, it would have to have been someone who not only suffered that way, but managed to be functional enough to have access to the tools and time necessary and skill necessary to do this, which now would have been rare, and would have been far rarer then in 1420. So, again, you run into a wall in analyzing this thing. My theory is that maybe in 500 years we'll figure it out. Maybe it's a reverse anachronism in the future. But by definition, we can't understand it, and I don't claim to understand it. All I can do is sit here and be amazed at the problem.
I must say, I had not heard of the Voynich manuscripts until I realized it was in your book. And you've mentioned about some of the drawings in there. In that particular time, I mean, it's believed to be around 1420, I'm guessing that there weren't too many people who had the degree of being literate to even write that in some make-believe language.
Right. This made up a consistent make-believe language and filled up a whole book.
Yes. Quite amazing.
It's dumbfounding, yeah.
One would wonder what the object of a varied degree of illustrations were in there. I mean, astronomy is no mean subject to deal with. You said there were plants. It's quite amazing, really.
Right. Plumbing appeared to be, I don't know, making wine from weird-looking grapes. It just goes on and on. But again, it doesn't quite match anything that's actually known. So if he's pulling it out of his head, doing a great job, but again, you would expect after, 240 pages to get some idea of what it's all based on. You'd find some crack in the armor. You'd see through it and see where he's getting all getting his ideas. And that never happens. Again, if it's maybe somebody who did work in scriptorium, as I call it then, did have OCD and did do this. It would probably take a year to do it. It would only take one person, but it seems very unlikely. Now, some have insisted it must have been a hoax. But if it was a hoax, why would you go to the extent of inventing a language that's mathematically consistent as a language? Now, to say if you took like an ordinary text or something, or even word salad, and encrypt it, the results would be, the encryption would give it the mathematical model of an actual language, but it would still be word salad, because that's what you started out with, gibberish or word salad. And I'd say, well, that might be interesting if you were going to sell it to the CIA or something. And that would might, keep them bemused for several hours. I don't think it was an issue in 1420, so I don't think no one would bother to do that. So, again, it's another point of mystification.
It does make one wonder, in this modern age, with such clever computer technology, that, in fact, if someone really studied the manuscripts, they might find some clue to the nature of the language or even be able to translate some of it.
Well, that's been an ongoing project since shortly after World War II. Some of the brightest lights in the field of cryptography have been playing with this thing. And so far, they haven't come up with anything convincing, which is almost scary. Because it probably, I think, again, because we have no way to approach it. We have nothing in common with it. Maybe it is a language, but it's not one currently spoken. If it's a dead language, I think we'd know about it. If it's a future language, we don't have much. Again, we're kind of stymied there. There's no way to even approach the thing.
Lamont, still talking about this manuscript. Did you discover where it came from originally?
It came from someplace in Italy, basically. I forget the details. A guy named Voynich was the. It's named after a book dealer, I believe, in New York City, who brought it to light in 1912. They have a provenance for it that leads back into Italy, but they're not even sure how much of that is real. But they are able to date it scientifically, again, to about 1420.
Right. Okay, we'll move on from that one, Lamont. Tell us a bit about the map from China, the 1602 map that you refer
that
to.
That one kind of leaks out, actually. The Chinese were not... call themselves the Middle Kingdom, and what few maps of the world they had ever done before then were basically, maps of China, and on either end they did have some clumps in there saying, rest of the world or whatever, and they weren't really interested in it. And then in 1602, we find a map published in China, in Chinese calligraphy, that looks vaguely like something you would get from National Geographic nowadays. The continents are all there, vaguely in the right place. Not really that accurate, really, in some cases. But like Baja California is there, and Africa and Europe are recognizable, and most of Asia is recognizable. Some things like Australia is kind of crude, and I think Malaysia's turned the wrong way, things like that. So it's like a hand-drawn map done by someone who... vague recollection of a world map or something. But the thing is, it's the projection. It's on a rectangular piece of paper. In fact, originally, I think it was like it was a huge wall map. I think it was like 12 feet long. But anyway, of course, the layout is, of course, rectangular, but within that, the world itself is done in an oval, a long oval, as you would see nowadays from a modern National Geographic wall map. And then the corners outside the oval within the rectangle, they have additional information like polar views and some other astronomical information. Again, as you would see in a National Geographic map. And the projection is pretty much like the projection invented in 1906 by a German geographer, Max Eckert Griffendorf. But again, this was made in 1602 in China. So we know, because it says in there, there's in the map in the Chinese calligraphy, there's actual credits. And we know one of the people behind it was a Christian missionary from Italy, and who we know was involved in geography. So he apparently was involved in it, a guy named Matteo Ricci, Jesuit missionary. One of his aims was to depict Europe as not being terribly threatening, being a long way off. So he puts China in the middle of the projection and Europe way off in one corner to sort of soothe their nerves. I'm not sure it had any effect, but... as for the 1906 projection, we presume he came up with that on his own. in order again to leave space, and because I think the Chinese knew as well as anybody else that the world is round, and when you project that onto a flat map, you run into problems. You have to have a consistent projection. Now, how, like I say, he came across that to make it look so modern, we don't know. But again, people often think in parallel lines, centuries apart. And I assume that was what was happening here. He took an approach that we now think is quite modern, and really wasn't used between then and now. But you have to give him credit. He came up with it. Again, it's called the black tulip. There are no black tulips. You're surprised to discover one, and they're very surprised to discover this thing. It's been around, again, since 1602. It's not unknown. But there's only a few copies. It's very rare. But nowadays, of course, the number of copies is immaterial that you can put on the Internet, and that's where you can find this thing nowadays.
Yeah. That's certainly very interesting. It raises the same type of questions, I suppose, as the Piri Reis map.
Oh, yes. That is the one by the Turkish admiral that they think shows the Western Hemisphere, or at least parts of North America, correct? And I think in this case, we can pretty much account for everything there. The Jesuit missionary, Ritchie, probably brought with him enough geographical knowledge to fill in the rest of the world, and the Chinese very, very good at mapping China. So probably this is the first time this has ever, those two things were ever combined in one map. But
right.
Again, he came up with a projection, a wall map that looks like something National Geographic would make. Although, admittedly, you have to kind of stand back and blur your eyes, because when you look at it carefully, it really isn't that accurate. Like Australia doesn't really exist, but the peninsula out of Antarctica, et cetera.
Still very fascinating. What about references to pillars of light, something that could be laser beams or death rays?
Oh, okay. Well, I have a couple of chapters on the often forgotten Siege of Syracuse by the Romans in about 212 B.C. Sounds like an esoteric topic, but three different ancient historians, Greek and Roman, leave fairly detailed accounts of what happened. This event was in the middle of the Punic Wars between Rome and Carthage, which was sort of a death match between those two empires. And it went on for like three generations and eventually led to destruction of Carthage and what is now Tunisia and North Africa. And so it was the biggest thing in the history of ancient Rome, really, sort of the defining moment, and is quite well documented, probably better than most other ancient events. And like I said, we have fairly detailed accounts from three different ancient historians, some of which are obviously based on first-hand accounts they got hold of. But they describe the Romans landing and approaching the city walls and being met by indirect fire coming over the walls at them that they couldn't escape. Usually if you got close enough to the walls, it couldn't hit you with indirect fire coming over the walls. Mm-hmm. But this the fire continued to track them, the missile fire, you know, rocks and arrows and stuff. This would imply finely tuned catapults, centralized fire control and fairly accurate range finders, stuff you don't see until, you know, the 20th century, usually. Then they came back for a night attack on a place where the city wall came down right down in front of the ocean. And they brought their ships up against the wall, were going to scale over them with Marines using scaling ladders from the ships. But then these large machines rose up on the other side of the city walls, which reached out and either dropped large rocks onto the ships or actually dropped grappling hooks that they then used to sort of grappled and pulled them up, you know, like you're fishing with them. And either I pulled them out of the water, dropped them, or caused them to capsize because they pull up one side and the other side went down, or they flipped them over, something like that. And the Romans turned and fled in panic, but gave up trying to assault the place, but eventually laid siege and starved them to submission. That took about 3 years. Now, the simplest explanation of what was going on is that inside the walls, in charge of defense planning, was a guy named Archimedes, whom you may have heard of, who invented the Archimedes screw and came up with a mathematical description of the lever and a whole bunch of other things. Basically, he's one of the world's first true scientists, I believe. One of the other things about the siege that is less well documented, because those ancient Roman and Greek historians I mentioned don't say anything about it. It shows up in later accounts of the battle, Byzantine times, 600 years later, saying he had basically what we would call death rays to set fire to Roman ships in the harbor. Presumably he had, and I think the medieval accounts say this, he had like billboard-sized arrays of metal mirrors that he would focus on the enemy ships to set fire to them. Well, the problem with that is that modern reconstructions show it doesn't work all that well. You just can't make them, you know, burst into flames. You can start charring them or something. But if they have a crew of, with, you know, buckets of water or something, they could counteract that. I think it was, he may have done it, but it was probably setting fire to the enemy ships was secondary. And while I was thinking about this, I happened to be watching one of these Celebrity Puff news shows, and they were talking about Jennifer Aniston's birthday party being held at a Mexican resort at the southern tip of Baja California, which is, of course, in the northern hemisphere facing south. And and they were being pestered, her and her friends, by these paparazzi in these boats just beyond the surf. So the management of the resort got lined up people with large mirrors, you know, like wall mirrors, you know, from the backs of the bathroom doors or something, and had them reflect the sunlight in the faces of these photographers out there.
And hello.
The surf, and that, yeah, and that, like, drove them away. They couldn't take pictures, gave them migraines, couldn't handle it. And, okay, what if the stakes were higher? What if those people were armed, you know? And it might be something you could do to keep them at arm's length. Also, if you had, like,
right, Lamont, I'm going to have to stop you now.
Okay.
We lost you a bit there because the internet connection broke, but you were still there, fortunately. I have to thank you very much for coming onto the program. I know your book is available through Amazon and other good sources.
Okay. And the title is Out of Place in Time and Space. I do have a Facebook page for it, and you can get it on Amazon and better bookstores, for that matter.
Yes, great. Okay. Because we've lost a couple of minutes there, I'm a little bit pushed now to end the program. I've got to announce next week's guest, but it's a very intriguing subject. We could have no doubt talked for about another half hour or more.
Oh,
so
easily,
thank you very much for coming along. It was great.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Lamont. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Right, friends, sorry about the little break there. Next week I've got Kelly Hampton, who's a channel and medium and a healer. She, amongst other people, she channels Archangel Michael. So that should be something a little bit different to what I normally have, but again, very interesting. Thank you for being with me today. Hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you can make it next week. God bless you all. Thank you very much.